All the way on the other side of the country, it begins to descend. Down, down, down. And of all the places it could have landed, you know, in a river, in a factory parking lot, in the sea. Instead, the balloon touches down in the yard of this girl.
I live in the countryside in a little village called Milton Lilbourne.
Just so you're not confused, this is a different girl than the first one. They do sound the same, but they live on opposite ends of the country.
The balloon got stuck in our hedge, but our next door neighbour found it, and he thought it was just a bit of rubbish, and he collected it up so the cows wouldn't eat it, because he didn't want the cows to, like, choke on the rubbish. And he was about to put it in the bin, like, literally. And then he saw the label saying, please send back to Laura Buxton. And he was like, oh my God.
Why? Why would he say, oh my God?
Okay, so check this out. Uh-huh. Remember how I told you that the first girl who sent the balloon was 10?
Yeah.
The second girl who received it?
I'm 10 years old.
She's 10. Okay?
Okay.
No, wait, there's more.
Better be.
Remember how I told you that the first girl's name was Laura Buxton?
Yeah.
Well, girl number two, can you introduce yourself?
Okay, hi, I'm Laura Buxton.
What?
Girl number one.
Hello, I'm Laura Buxton.
Girl number two.
Hello, I'm Laura Buxton.
They're both Laura Buxton?
Yeah.
No.
Yes.
Both named Laura Buxton.
Yes.
Get out!
You heard me right. A 10-year-old girl named Laura Buxton lets go of a balloon.
Phew!
That balloon floats 140 miles and lands in the yard of another 10-year-old girl named Laura Buxton.
This is for real?
Yes. I think it might be the strangest thing I've ever heard in my life.
It's pretty weird.
So weird, we had to get them both into a studio.
Hello, New York, this is London, can you hear me?
So, like, we're going to hear Americans through these.
This balloon thing happened about 8 years ago, so both Lauras are now 18, and they've actually become really good friends. Anyhow, back to the story.
Yeah, I got the balloon.
That's Laura number two. What did you think at that point?
I was quite young, so I didn't really know what to think. I was just like, I better write the letter because, you know, there's someone else out there called Laura Buxton. I must see them.
So Laura number two wrote a letter to Laura number one.
Dear Laura, I think I put, I'm 10 years old and I live in Wiltshire and I found your balloon. And thing is that my name is Laura Buxton as well. So lots of love from Laura Buxton.
Laura number one.
Yep.
You get the note.
Got it through the post.
Do you remember reading it?
I remember reading it because I sort of opened it up whilst I was in the kitchen. And it was really quite confusing, actually.
Okay, a short while later, the two Lauras meet.
Hi.
Hello.
And at that moment, things get even weirder. They realize, when they see each other for the first time, oh my God, not only do we have the same name and are the same age, but we look the same. Same height.
Skinny and tall. And
same color hair.
Brownish hair. And I remember the weirdest thing was that we were wearing really similar clothes.
Yeah,
which I always thought was, that was just so weird.
What were you wearing? Do you remember?
Pink jumpers and jeans.
Yeah.
So you both had on pink jumpers and jeans?
Yeah.
And as they started to talk, it just kept getting weirder.
Well, we'd both got a 3-year-old black Labrador. We'd both got a grey rabbit. We'd both got guinea pigs.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And they both brought their guinea pigs with them that day.
I remember Laura took hers out of its cage and I had mine on my lap. And we were like, oh my God.
They were identical.
They were both brown with a sort of beigey orange patch on their bum. Like, completely the same.
I was just like, oh my gosh, how is this happening?
Do you believe in miracles? Either of you?
I don't know, would you call this a miracle?
I'm not sure. I mean, I guess it could be, but I think it's more of a case of fate.
Yeah, I'd say it's more fate than a miracle.
So you don't think that wind that blew the balloon was just wind?
Well, if it was just wind, it was a very, very lucky wind. The chances are just so unlikely, there must be some kind of reason.
What kind of reason?
Maybe we were meant to meet, I don't know.
But meant by whom? Or what?
Who knows, really? I mean, only time will tell. It could actually be, like, preparing us for something else later in life. Yeah, who
maybe
knows?
When we're old grannies, we'll find out. No, we're just young and we're just enjoying life.
Ted, I mean, whether you look what you know what you are.
What?
You're a destiny bully. You know, like, what are you bearing?
What, you call me a destiny bully?
Yes.
Sounds
because
like a pop
you,
band or something.
No, it's what you're doing to those girls. You want them to act like they are somehow the subject of a miracle.
No, I wasn't trying to force God on them, if that's what you mean.
Yes, you're the one who says, oh, who's behind
no,
this?
No, the question I was trying to get at is, like, how should we think about that story? Mm. Do we live in a world where there's magic and meaning, or is it all just chance. That was the beginning of A Lucky Wind, produced by Jad Abumrad and Soren Wheeler for WNYC's Radiolab. In the rest of the story, Soren, Jad, and co-host Robert Krulwich examine the statistics behind this unlikely story of the two Laura Buxtons and explore why chance so often feels like fate. And believe me, you will never hear a more delightful story about probability. The judges were blown away by not just the compelling storytelling, but by the amazing sound of it. As one of the judges put it, Robert, Jad, and Soren turn radio into music. We invite you to listen to the rest of this radio song. Just visit thirdcoastfestival.org. Last year, the Third Coast Festival added a new award to its lineup, the Best News Feature, which honors a story characterized by exemplary reporting and journalistic integrity, combined with strong writing, social importance, and compelling use of sound. This year's winner is a shining example of just such a story. It's by independent producer Gregory Warner, who traveled deep into the Democratic Republic of Congo to visit Bisie, where most of the world's coltan is mined. Now, you may never have heard of coltan, but it's a mineral used in almost every electronic device you own. Cell phone, laptop, the works. The coltan industry generates hundreds of millions of dollars a year, but the big profits never trickle down to the miners, who work in very primitive conditions. Reporter Gregory Warner was allowed just 3 days to get his story. On the second day, he went down into a mine and found Fidel Musafiri, a man who spends most of his time underground, literally trying to hammer out an existence.
Here's how you find Fidel Musafiri. First, you walk for 2 days through the jungle until you come to a mountain scarred with sandy pits and dotted with little black tunnels. Climb down a log ladder into one of the tunnels, turn on your flashlight, and walk to the end. And there you find him, perched on a narrow ledge over a dark shaft. A small guy with no shirt on and a big headlamp, pounding a steel spike into a little hole in the rock. In Swahili, Fidel tells me his fantasy, that he has a jackhammer. No one has one this far into the jungle, of course, and without it, the work is painfully slow.
Hammering for hours and hours.
It's not only a jackhammer he's missing. Fidel doesn't have anything that a miner might want, like a hard hat, or insurance, or engineers, or geologists to guide the work. Fidel is what's called an artisanal miner, a freelancer. He digs a hole, sticks in dynamite, explodes it, and then hopes for a mineral in the rubble. He works for the tunnel owner, and he keeps just a cut of what he finds.
No one knows what is under the ground. No, it depends on God.
Who taught you how to do this work? How did you learn?
Apatu. Just here. There is no school for this.
Fidel's now 35 years old. He walked here 6 years ago from a village 300 miles away. He lives with his wife and daughter now at the base of the mountain, but he hasn't been home in a week. He slept here, on the rock. His bed is a crushed plastic jug. Fidel tells me his wife prefers it this way.
Do I go back home with empty pockets? My sleeping here encourages my wife. She knows, since my husband didn't come, so he's looking for money.
Fidel dreams of reaching what miners call a clean board. That's a rock face of pure mineral. Then he'd have lots to sell. Fidel's friend Kumani says, a clean board means money.
Our wish is that we are in front of a board. Then we are bosses and we are happy.
Fidel says, yeah, a clean board does attract the buyers. But it also brings the soldiers, former rebels that now wear government uniforms but still control the mine like mafiosi. They take a cut of the minerals that leave the mine. And more recently, they've started going into the tunnels with guns, forcing out the workers and mining themselves. If they leave Fidel's tunnel alone for now, it's only because he hasn't found enough profitable rock.
They can come and take what they can take, and they leave us what they leave. There is no other choice.
When Fidel needs a stretch or a bite to eat, he steps outside the tunnel. Merchants are there in booths made of wood poles and plastic sheeting. They sell corned beef and also fried bread and cheap gin and headlamps and radios and fancy pointy shoes. But Fidel just buys a plate of hot rice and beans and hops back into the tunnel. He already owes these merchants way too much money for the dynamite he's going to use in the work. But if you go past the merchants, you'll find the buyers with their metal scales, and then the soldiers demanding a smoke.
Can you keep us walking?
And the farther you climb down the muddy path, trying not to slip off the cliff or into one of the open pits, it's like a labyrinth, crowded with shirtless young workers, their skin caked with mud from tunnels, some of them drunk or fighting, or watching French films on a TV hooked to a generator. And drinking more, and all this continues through the night. So that even from your campsite in the jungle, in your sleeping bag with the insects all around, you can still hear from far off the noise of the men and their shouts. Back in the tunnel the next morning, Fidel seems giddy, like after an all-nighter. I find him dumping rocks onto a plastic jug. Actually, that's his bed. He'd exploded the dynamite last night and blasted loose about 100 pounds of coltan. He bangs off the impurities with a spike. With rocks in his hand, Fidel sits taller. He shouts for a trader to come buy some of his mineral. What's keeping him? Tell him to move it. Finally, the trader does come, bringing his scale, and Fidel measures off 2 kilos, $6. Companies in China or India will pay six times that much once a long string of middlemen have taken their cut. Then Fidel stands. He says he has to go to base camp, where his wife and daughter live, because there he can sell the coltan for a bit more per kilo. So we set off down the trail with Fidel out in front with his gray cowboy hat and behind him a wrinkled porter carrying the bag of mineral strapped to a big sled on his back. And the trouble starts almost as soon as we leave the tunnel. First, a teenager in a Houston Rockets jersey demands a dollar for some kind of census. We get past that one, but then a military officer tries to arrest Fidel for no apparent crime other than walking with a bag of mineral. And Fidel does not look surprised. He doesn't even say anything. I'm the one who has to plead with the officer.
Mm-hmm. Because if you arrest him now, it's going to become a big production. Because you're going to go to the commander, it's going to be a big...
And finally, we're allowed to go. But it's late afternoon by the time we cross the river into the settlement. Fidel rents just a piece of a house, a room about the size of a horse stable. There's no door, just a curtain. There's no chair and no room for one. The mud wall has holes that let in the sunlight and the noise.
No.
And on the bed, there's his wife, and she's not speaking.
Is she sick?
Yeah.
This was not the homecoming that I'd expected. Her lips are chapped. Her eyes are sunken. She has malaria, and she's malnourished. If she doesn't get help soon, she'll die. Fidel just takes her hand and sits down at the edge of the bed.
You haven't been home in a week, and she's been sick this whole time?
Yes. The whole week she has been suffering.
Fidel looks down, helpless, not at all like the man I met back in the tunnel, smiling with tools in his hands. Even with the bag of coltan he's earned this week, some of that money is for his boss, some to buy more dynamite. The rest just pays for food. There's no money for a doctor.
I have the impression that things are getting wrong. So I'm getting a bit pessimistic. I begin losing hope.
As I left, I asked Fidel if he had any regrets spending the last 6 years in the mine. I know it's a tough question, but he said no. He'd made his choice. And tomorrow, when the sun rises, he'd go back to his tunnel, pick up his hammer and his spike, and keep searching for that clean board.
That was Fidel Musafiri, Miner, by Gregory Warner, winner of the 2009 Third Coast Best News Feature Award. In the words of one of the judges, the story is heroic journalism in poetic form. Gregory overcame tremendous obstacles to report this story, including resistance from the soldiers who oversaw the operations at the mine. And we spoke with him about how he found Fidel and chose him as his subject.
There was no way to interview anybody on the top of the mountain just because it was too exposed, too chaotic. There was no privacy in a place like this. There's nowhere to go. So we went into these mines, and in the mines, paradoxically, it's actually extremely peaceful, great sound, very, very quiet, and not a bad place to interview workers. Unfortunately, it's completely pitch dark. So we would go down with our headlamps, and basically, I would have a headlamp and a microphone. I would say, hey, you want to talk to me? You know, and we did that once or twice to no great luck, and then it was the afternoon of the second day. We went down a mine shaft, and Fidel was there. And I said, excuse me, do you mind if we ask you a few questions? We're some journalists from America. And he said, I was born in an educated home, and my parents taught me always to be polite to strangers. You can ask me anything you wish. It's hard to explain how surprising that was after all the hostility and the anger we had been exposed to for the last 7 days. And I really wanted to just hang out forever in the middle in the mine. I just didn't want to leave.
Do you feel like there's hope in Fidel's story or in the story that you told of Fidel?
I think that when you're telling a story about one person who is affected by huge, large global forces beyond his control, there's a kind of thrill in just focusing on that person's life, just him. Even though his life is so difficult and kind of incomprehensible, how he wakes up for work every day. Lots of people wake up for work every day, and he does too, and he finds his reasons.
Gregory Warner, producer of Fidel Musafiri, Minor. The story is part of the Homelands production series called Working, which profiles workers around the world and originally aired on Marketplace. To see pictures of Fidel or to hear a longer interview with Gregory, visit thirdcoastfestival.org.
Radio's most indispensable ambition.
From small to big.
To feed the desire to wonder.
From the world to the heart.
The eruption of some surprising feeling or thought.
To the head. The imagination, to space, to illumination.
Once upon a time.
I'm Gwen Maxey, and you're listening to the 2009 Third Coast broadcast. The Third Coast International Audio Festival is an independent, nonprofit media arts organization, and our work is made possible with lead support from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Questions? Comments? Answers and annotations can be found at info@thirdcoastfestival.org. Coming up after the break, this year's Best New Artist. This broadcast comes to you from the Third Coast Festival and PRI, Public Radio International.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta is now open in their new location at Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana. Their 8-week winter session in Iyengar Yoga starts November 30th with special classes for beginners, women, seniors, and plus sizes. Gift certificates are available. Information at 344-YOGA or on the web at yoga-cu.com.
Welcome back to the 2009 Third Coast broadcast, featuring the year's best radio. I'm Gwen Maxey.
Once upon a time.
Once upon a time.
Once upon a time.
When you hear a great story, the rest of the world just drops away. Time slows down, your heart speeds up, and you never know where it might transport you. Listening brings the campfire into your living room, stars and all.
All I can say is that, and I have to go back to my own childhood, I'd never heard anything so wonderful as the voices that came out of the little box.
Some of the radio's brightest stars are its newest, young people on their way up who show promise, creativity, and moxie. Each year, the Third Coast Festival honors an emerging radio talent. This year's Best New Artist Award goes to April Dymbosky for Death Comes Home. This is the story of three families figuring out how to handle the death of a loved one, where and how to honor the body, what kind of service to perform, and what grieving should look like, all without the help of a funeral home or undertaker. They're part of a growing movement of people who are reclaiming death rights and creating their own ways to honor their dead. April Dymbosky followed the three families' stories closely, respectfully, and produced this intimate portrait of grief and recovery. In this excerpt of Death Comes Home, we'll hear two people talk about loved ones who died and some of the ceremonies they designed to mark their passing. The first voice you'll hear is Jim Wheaton's, whose friends and family worked together to pay respects to his deceased wife.
Word went out during the dinner that anyone who wanted to bring something to put in the coffin to go with her could do so. And boy, people started to show up during and after the dinner. And they brought flowers and photographs. People penned notes. We also pulled some things that were important to her. One of her quilts that she had been working on, that she actually made with cloth that she'd bought on our honeymoon in Costa Rica. Then we all sat in a big circle around the coffin in the living room. And each person put their item in and told a story, or not, as they chose, about what it was and why they were doing it and so forth. And again, the boy, Jesse, was amazing. He got up partway through, and people, of course, crying, and it's very upsetting. And he walked into the room and came back, and he brought back a box of Kleenex and started handing out Kleenex to people. And then when it was all over, we had this coffin full of stuff. And then he looked at me and said, "Dad, where's my glue stick?" And I said, "Glue stick? I don't know. It's probably up with your art stuff." He said, "Okay." And he ran upstairs, came back down, and said, "What do you need that for?" He says, "I want the pictures to be up." He didn't want the pictures to just cast in the bottom of the coffin. He wanted them up on the walls of the coffin so they could be seen. And so he very carefully sat there and he glue-sticked all of the photos to the sides of the coffin.
Hello? Hello? Hi. Yes. Mm-hmm. 4:20 yesterday afternoon, and if you want to come out of curiosity, I'm okay with that too. Okay, you know what I mean? I mean, not too many people do this. Uh-huh. You just go to L Street.
It is the day after Mike died. The second day he's been in Joan's house.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Joan added some personal touches to the casket. She laid two of his hunting bows and a set of arrows over the foot of the casket. She set up some candles, bear skulls from one of Mike's hunting trips, and a bottle of Jack Daniels. A prized deer head hangs on the wall overlooking the casket.
This is in the record book. There's a record book called Pope and Young, record book for a bow.
Joan also set Mike up with some essentials. She put a pack of cigarettes in his shirt pocket and a lighter and a couple of bucks in his pants. Still, something was missing. His glasses.
I had to clean them first. That was also a thing with us. He'd come home from work or he'd be wherever, and I'd look at his glasses. I said, "How the hell can you see out of those glasses?" It's like, you know, and then he'd just look at me, and I'd wash his glasses, sometimes with detergent. And so I washed them this morning before I put them on.
Joan leans on the casket as she talks. She says having Mike's body so close has made his death more real.
I'm learning something about myself. I'm one of these people that when something's happening, like you put your finger through a saw or, you know, somebody jumps out in front of you with a car, I scream, "Ah!" while I'm doing what I need to do, right? Then I'm all real calm, and then I do whatever else I need to do, and then later I howl.
That was a selection from Death Comes Home by 2009 Best New Artist April Dymbosky. As one judge put it, Dymbosky's strength is using the magic tools of casting, interviewing, editing, and structuring so that real, three-dimensional human beings share their lives with us through a radio speaker. To hear the whole story, or to see beautiful pictures of some of the incredibly intimate scenes you just heard, visit thirdcoastfestival.org.
I believe that one of the principal ways in which we acquire, hold, and digest information is via narrative.
Once upon a time.
Some radio stories can really pack a wallop, shedding light on important issues, revealing hidden corners of the human experience, and in the process, changing people's lives. The winner of this year's Third Coast Radio Impact Award does just that. The story tackles a sensitive subject with grace and respect. In Ontario, Canada, decades' worth of official adoption records were recently unsealed, creating the potential for hundreds of thousands of people to meet their biological family members for the first time. While this is welcome news for those who are searching, there's a disconcerting, albeit rare, consequence of some adoptive reunions. It's called genetic sexual attraction, or GSA, and it results in a sexual relationship between adult biological relatives. Because of the taboo associated with these relationships, people experiencing GSA suffer shame, fear, and secrecy. The phenomenon isn't new, and it's not entirely unknown in the adoption community. It just isn't talked about much. Producer Aziza Sindhu, winner of this year's Third Coast Radio Impact Award, has researched the phenomenon and spoken with people who've experienced it firsthand.
It's like falling in love is how people explain it to me. It's this bond that these people have had. They didn't really know that they had it, but when you finally meet someone and you've never met them, it's this incredible urge to merge as one from what I've been told. And then this sexual attraction is what can create issues for people.
So in your research, did you find out how common genetic sexual attraction is? How many psychologists are aware of it? And in general, like what kind of support there is?
Some adoption agencies talk about it. There's little pamphlets that go out with people who are going to be reunited. It's known, but you get a little paragraph or a little pamphlet. And people will read that and think, that's not going to happen to me.
How did your feeling about any of the subjects you interviewed change over the course of the interview and what you found out about them and got to know them?
It changed a lot. I think it changed when we first started talking over the phone. No one went into this saying, great, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm so happy. If you want to talk to somebody who's really ripped up on the inside, they all were ripped up on the inside. And it's hard to see people suffering. And you know that when people are suffering for other reasons, we give them a lot of empathy. These people are not going to get any empathy if they went out with their story. Sometimes they might. This story might do it for them. But nobody knows who they are. So they're struggling with all this pain. And I think for me, I felt it.
That was Aziza Sindhu. And now here's an excerpt from her documentary, Forbidden Love, Genetic Sexual Attraction. You'll hear the story of a man who, after being reunited with his biological sister, fell in love with her. He and his wife both speak frankly about the impact the experience had on their family. As you might expect, there are some mature themes ahead.
My heart wanted to just leave my rest of my life and just walk away into the sunset with this person. I tried to go to sleep, pretended to go to sleep. I was there in the bed next to my wife, and I just was absent. It was paralyzing.
I was in a coffee shop. I just looked at him and I said, "You're having an affair." And he said, "How? What do you mean?" And I said, "Well, I think that this is with your biological sister." And he said, "Yes." He said, "It is." And he cried. And he couldn't understand why he was feeling the way he was, because he was so frightened. He was so frightened of it. He had a hole in his heart. Something was missing. It was always missing. He was always searching, always looking for something that was missing.
It's like there was a parallel thing, two parallel things going on together. One was the adoption reunion of me and a birth family, and one was my soulful reunion of me and my soulmate. I just felt this darkness descending over me. You know, I don't think my life's going to be worth living. And the impossible position of knowing something was absolutely right at the same time knowing that you can never have it. It was the most personal secret that I've ever had inside me. And
I mean, the only word that is known for it is incest. And that is not acceptable in society, and it's not acceptable by anybody. And I thought, well, he's not capable of that. So what is this? If it's not that, what is it?
I don't even know what incest is. It wasn't incest to me. Absolutely not. Didn't even occur to me. That's just a tawdry kind of a cheap. That cheapens the whole thing. It was nothing about incest, or it's nothing about sex either. People who think that at that level just are missing the point, and they need to think about it a little deeper than that. Incest is a thing that happens. That there's a position of power or abuse. And anybody that thinks this is that needs to reevaluate that, because that's just absolutely wrong. It's a bigger, bigger thing than that.
Probably about 6-7 years. Yeah, of hell. Maybe longer. I felt extremely alone because there was help for adoptees. There was nothing for the immediate families. There was no help. My husband went to a support group, and he brought home a lot of information, and which was very helpful. But I couldn't go to the meetings, so I had nobody to help me. And he was trying to help himself. He couldn't help anybody at the time. He was so devastated.
And I remember there was one paltry little three-line paragraph in some article that I don't even remember where it was now, that sometimes this can happen. I just skimmed over it. And so in the back of my mind, I guess I had some awareness that there are many issues around adoption reunions, and this being one of them, but I'd never really thought about it too much.
That was a selection from Forbidden Love, Genetic Sexual Attraction, by Aziza Sindhu and Aaron Brindle, winners of the 2009 Third Coast Radio Impact Award. The story first aired on The Current, a news and current affairs show on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Besides the emotional impact the story had on listeners, it made a tangible difference. Forbidden Love is now being used by adoption groups and adoption therapists as a launching pad for discussion. To hear the story in its entirety, visit thirdcoastfestival.org. I'm Gwen Macsai, and you're listening to the 2009 Third Coast Broadcast. The Third Coast International Audio Festival is an independent, nonprofit media arts organization, and our work is made possible with lead support from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Coming up after the break, why do kids stop going to school, and where do they go instead? This broadcast comes to you from the Third Coast Festival and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910. Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting audiences with an exciting January schedule of events featuring the Moscow Festival Ballet, Kronos Quartet with Wu Man, and Michael Rouse. More information can be found online at krannertcenter.com.
Welcome back to the 2009 Third Coast Broadcast. I'm Gwen Macsai.
I think myself as a... hopefully, as a storyteller. What is the story?
Which is the more powerful key to the senses, generally?
I don't know.
And I think it's the ear.
Good storytelling does not necessarily need to be gussied up. Sometimes the simpler, the better. The power of our next story is in its straightforward, crisp writing and fearless, dogged reporting. In the Chicago public schools, about 50% of freshmen entering high school never make it to graduation. A lot of kids just stop coming to class. But why? Where do they go? And how do they spend their days? In her riveting documentary, Gone, 2009 Third Coast Honorable Mention winner Linda Lutton tracks down three absent students from Robeson High School to find out.
I start with the phone. The phone numbers Robeson has on file for students are often bad. Families move, or their phones get disconnected, or sometimes they don't want the school to be able to call.
We're sorry, your call cannot.
I'm looking for Tim. His home number is disconnected. There's a work number for his mom, but somebody there tells me she was fired a long time ago.
I'm not available right now, but please leave a message and I'll call you back.
The number of a family friend is busy all the time.
Thank you.
The address listed for Tim is 220 East 75th Street.
So I don't see a 220, but there's a 200. It's a one-story building.
Right about where Tim's house is supposed to be, there's a parking lot. I imagine all the letters that Robeson High School has sent to this parking lot. Certified letters warning Tim's parents to send him to school. My last lead on Tim is the family friend. His name is Mr. Gunn. I find his address online. The door to Mr. Gunn's building is unlocked, and the whole foyer smells like reefer. I finally find Mr. Gunn around the back of the building. I tell him I'm looking for Tim.
I'm not related to him at all. I'm 60 years old. I'm just trying to help them out by when they call, I go tell his father when he's not in school. Now, they were living over here on the next block right there at the end of that alley on the end. But they're not there anymore. Now, first gray house you get to on that side of the street, that's where they moved to.
The house is two stories with a big stoop. With all the calls and stops, it's probably taken me 3 hours to get here. But I've finally found Tim. A very wide smile comes across his face, and then he turns away.
Can you figure out why I came to look for you?
No.
Because you haven't been at Robeson.
Oh.
You might think there'd be a big reason why Tim hasn't been in school. Like maybe it's drugs, gangs. Maybe Tim's got to work to help his family. He's the 8th out of 10 kids.
I had to take shots.
Shots?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
I had to go to the hospital and take shots.
It's not that he's sick. He isn't up to date on his vaccinations. That's why he hasn't been in school. His brother, who's also a freshman, is out for the same reason. They've both been gone since December, which is when Tim says the school gave him a paper telling him he couldn't come back without proof he'd gotten his shots.
After they gave me the paper, I tried to go back. They asked me, did I take my shots? Did I say no? They said I couldn't come without my shots. They sent me back around. They told me I can't come without my shots, so I ain't tried to go since.
Tim says he hasn't gotten the shots because his mom and dad both work, and nobody can miss a day because that's $100 off their check. He says his older brothers and sisters can't take him to get the shots because they don't have IDs.
If I had a choice to walk my own self to the hospital, I would have been back in school a long time ago. I was going to go up to Robeson at the last day and see if it was summer school, though, because I want to get back in school. I like going to school.
Tim wasn't a bad student. He got C's his last year of grammar school. He was never identified as a potential dropout by Robeson, and a lot of other kids were. But Tim was no angel either. One day in the fall, I was hanging around with his math teacher, Mr. Kyriakos, while he was making phone calls home.
Hi, my name is Mr. Kyriakos. I teach at Robeson High School.
Here's what Mr. Kyriakos told the family friend, Mr. Gunn.
It's about Timothy's attitude in class and his behavior. He's cursing more often. He doesn't care who hears him curse. And he's been more willing to start arguments with other students.
It's Mr. Kyriakos' job to call home for issues like this. But CPS says teachers aren't social workers. They can't be expected to track kids down at home. Truancy officers were cut from schools in the early 1990s. Community and religious groups have picked up some of the slack, but they can't reach the thousands who go missing.
Thank you.
Mr. Kyriakos told me last winter he hoped when the weather changed, when spring came, maybe Tim would return.
Have any of your teachers called you?
No.
No? Has anybody come around and looked for you?
No, but you.
I say to Tim, why don't I take you to school tomorrow? You can explain that you haven't gotten the shots, but you want to come to school, and we'll see what happens.
So come here at 8, like 7:30, and I'll be ready.
But when I get there, Tim is sleeping. His mom comes out to talk to me on the stoop. She knows that I stopped by the day before, and she says right off that none of her kids is going to drop out of school. She tells me that the problem is the form that they gave Tim for his vaccinations, he lost it.
You want Tim in school?
Yes, I do.
Do you know when he'll get his shots?
And well, Saturday. I guess Saturday. Today, Thursday. Guess Saturday.
But he hasn't had the shot since December, right? That's when they sent the paper home?
Right. Since December, when they sent the paper home.
Can you say, I mean, why has it been so hard to get those shots?
Like I said, he lost the paper. He lost the paper himself, not me, he did. The nurse gave him the paper, she didn't give it to me. I don't go to school, I'm 44 years old.
The form Tim lost is available at any clinic, but maybe Tim's mom doesn't know this. She says she'll bring Tim to the doctor as soon as he gets another paper.
You want me to take
I offer to take Tim to Robeson right then to get the paper, but his mom lets him sleep.
I'll send him up there. I have my nephew take him up there in his car and get the paper so he can't get back to school. Because I told him, oh, you going to summer school, buddy. Oh, you going to summer school. Because I know he got to go. You going to summer school.
I figure that finding Marcellus will be a lot easier than finding Tim. There's a working phone number. I find his address in the phone book. But when I get to Marcellus's house, I find that nobody knows where he is. Not exactly, anyway. This is his grandma.
I really don't know where he is. I can say I believe he's on 69th in Indiana or 69th in Calumet, but I did see him. It looked like him, and I'm pretty sure it was him going down Indiana.
The family filed a missing persons report with the police in April. Marcellus is 15 years old, and this is the fourth or fifth time he's run away from home.
No, that's not it. I thought that was the new one. Okay, what date is that one?
Hi, Linda. This is Officer Taylor from Chicago Police News Affairs about your request, April 16th, missing male 15-year-old. I talked to Area 2, and they are still investigating this. He is still considered a missing.
Marcellus's grandmother says Marcellus just didn't want to follow the rules anymore. He stole things. He'd come home high. Marcellus's mother died when he was 4. He and his brothers came to live with their grandma 3 years ago. Marcellus's aunt says she could see him being pulled by the neighborhood.
The streets or the gangs are providing him with some sort of emotional connection. And I guess he feels like he's a part of something. You know, it's hard when you don't have your parents. And although we're here, we're trying, but it's a certain void that he's trying to fill.
Marcellus's grandmother says one person at Robeson tried to help Marcellus, and that was Rodney Thomas, the head of a program to keep freshmen in school. But when I call Thomas later, he says he can't quite remember Marcellus. He has hundreds of kids to keep track of. Every day, Robeson's automated phone calling system dials up Marcellus's grandmother and tells her he's absent from school. Family members have tried to find Marcellus, but when he sees them, he runs away. So I get directions and set out to look for Marcellus myself.
I don't know the name, it's Arab Store. It's right across the street going directly south.
That's Indiana.
Right, stay on the east side of Indiana.
Excuse me. I'm looking for a student that I used to know. His name's Marcellus.
I don't know.
No?
It's a spring night and the block is full. A big group of men and boys are gambling on the sidewalk. One guy is holding a stack of bills.
Where is this pitch at?
I was looking for a boy I used to know. I used to stop by at Robeson High School.
And there's Marcellus leaning up against the car, the littlest one there.
Marcellus.
He's got a baby face.
Where you at, Shawty? Hey, come take over this one. Let's talk to
her. Marcellus's warm-up jacket is pulled up over his face, up to his nose, which is why he sounds all muffled.
What's up?
Put your thing down so I can talk to you.
All right, what's up?
You remember me, right?
Yeah.
This week I've been looking for kids who aren't in school anymore.
Okay, how you find me, though?
Marcellus really doesn't want to talk about why he's not in school, and I'm not sure I can trust what he's saying anyway. He's acting funny. His eyes are completely bloodshot. He lies and tells me he was in school yesterday, but he's really fixated on how I found him.
I don't get this. I mean, like, how y'all found me, man?
Have any of your teachers come out looking for you?
No, I don't want them. Nobody got to look for me.
I tell him I'm looking for the kids in his classes who don't come to school anymore.
So you going through everybody's neighborhood looking for these students. Wow.
I'm the one who's surprised when I find the third student, Kiana. She's at home on the sofa reading a book. I've watched Robeson teachers try hard to get students to read this year. And here I am with a kid who's not even coming to school anymore, and I find her with a book. The apartment where Kiana's family lives is clean and sunny. Her eighth grade graduation photo sits on a little end table. When I ask Kiana why she's not in school, this is what she tells me.
Well, I choose not to go to school because I get into too many fights. I feel like I can't get an education at Robeson. It's too much violence.
Robeson's principal is usually outside after school, which is when the fights tend to break out. He told me once he wishes it would rain every day at dismissal so kids would go straight home. Kiana started having problems her first week at Robeson.
The first fight I had, I got jumped on by 8 girls. Then the second fight.
Two more fights followed that one. Kiana tells me that a former friend has become her tormentor.
Then I decided I didn't want to go there no more. Because it seemed like I always get into a fight with her and I get suspended. And I think that I'm going to be a demo, and I'm not going to go to the next grade because I'll fight.
I'm trying to square what Kiana is telling me with what I'm seeing. The quiet, tidy apartment, the book. From the couch, she can see the Robeson kids coming home from school. Kiana almost cries when she tells me she fears being a demote. That's a demoted freshman. She says she was suspended for 40 or 50 days for fighting this year. Kiana's dad says he's gone to the school to figure things out.
I've been up to school so much, I might as well be taking a class up there.
He wishes Robeson could have come up with a way to keep the two girls apart.
She wants to be in school right now. And I want her to be in school right now. And the year is gone. This whole year is gone now. She's going to have to repeat this ninth grade over again. All because of this foolishness.
Kiana hardly leaves the house. Her mom says she's been depressed since she stopped going to school. Kiana and her parents say they asked for a transfer to a different school, but they were told they've got to wait till the end of the semester. Kiana's report card, out today, will almost surely be all Fs.
It's not that I'm choosing not to go to school no more. I just don't want to go to that school no more.
Kiana says she hasn't dropped out of school. In fact, all the kids tell me this, that they haven't dropped out. They've just stopped going. These kids will stay on Robeson's rolls, but if they don't return to school, eventually, quietly as they disappeared from class, their names will be dropped, along with 12,000 other kids.
That was Third Coast Honorable Mention Award winner, Gone, produced by Linda Lutton for Chicago Public Radio's series called 50-50, The Odds of Graduating. To hear more stories from the series, visit thirdcoastfestival.org. On this special Third Coast broadcast, we're listening to some of today's best documentaries. But each year, the Third Coast Festival likes to honor someone who's contributed not just to today, but to the yesterday and even the tomorrow of radio storytelling. Someone who has and continues to influence the entire radio world with his or her creativity, vision, leadership, and innovation. The 2009 Audio Luminary Award goes to a man whose work was an inspiration to many and whose mentorship spawned some of the most respected sound editors and designers in the business.
You'd be hard-pressed to find an individual in any profession as curious, as unpretentious, and as generous with his knowledge as Eric.
Whatever success I've had is because of the directions he sent me in.
I was stopped in my tracks the first time I heard Eric's voice.
He's Eric Bauersfeld, who at 87 is thought of as the father of American radio drama. Eric's career began in the early 1960s in California as head of drama and literature at KPFA in Berkeley, where he stayed for 30 years. One of his nominators put it perfectly when he said, "Eric is a true and generous friend for bards, storytellers, poets, and romantics who love the sound of wisdom disguised as entertainment." And it's true. Eric is not only a writer, producer, and director, he's also a consummate and delightful performer. Here's a taste of Object Piece, a radio play by Eric based on a short story by Drury Pyfer. In it, a museum commissions a conceptual art piece, asking a man to record himself digging his own grave in the Mojave Desert after he loses his wife to a friend. It originally aired on KPFA and the BBC in 1976. The voice you'll hear is Eric's.
It's okay. It's okay. The event is underway. Ah. There's a title. Well, I hate titles. I'm standing in a ditch in the middle of the Mojave Desert. Ladies and gentlemen of the museum, I like the Mojave Desert because it is dry and spare and not very talented. I identify with it. And I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you, ladies and gentlemen of the museum, for making this all possible. This ditch, I mean, this untitled ditch. I would also like to say hello to Judith, my lovely wife. Hello, Judith.
That was a taste of 2009 audio luminary Eric Bauersfeld's radio drama. To hear more and to find out about Eric's life and work, visit thirdcoastfestival.org.
These are my inspirations and my sources, and I says here my thanks to all.
Eric Bauersfeld.
And the Third Coast 2009 Audio Luminary Lifetime Achievement Award, which I accept on behalf of my colleagues. And I usually use the word tovarish because it sounds so much better. Tovarishes and nostrovnyas. Now we can have a vodka. Thank you very much.
Eric worked in radio drama, bringing fictional stories to life. But truth, as we know, can be even stranger than fiction. We celebrate the truth in all stories, wherever they come from, however they're told. Because whether they're grand and sweeping or compressed and tidy, in the best of them, somewhere, we see and hear ourselves.
Stories that comfort, nourish, amuse, provoke. Stories performed on the radio.
Thanks for joining us for this hour of the 2009 Third Coast broadcast featuring the winners of the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation competition. I'm Gwen Maxey. The program is produced by Delaney Hall and Katie Mingle for the Third Coast International Audio Festival and PRI, Public Radio International. To learn more about the Third Coast Festival, to hear all of this year's winners or winners from years past, to subscribe to our podcast, or to find out about our newly independent media arts organization, which carries out its audio festivities nonstop and year-round, check out thirdcoastfestival.org. The executive director of the festival is Johanna Zorn. The artistic director is Julie Shapiro. The festival is made possible with lead support from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Additional support is provided by the Boeing Company Charitable Trust, the National Endowment for the Arts, Chicago's Navy Pier, American Airlines, and ExploreChicago.org, the City of Chicago's official tourism website. The festival is produced in partnership with the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, and it was founded in 2000 by Chicago Public Radio. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This Thanksgiving holiday season, as we in the United States gather to celebrate the first ceremonial sharing between Native peoples and the arriving European peoples, we bring you another telling of this story, an update, so to speak. Try to imagine a different kind of Thanksgiving gathering, another way to begin making a nation today. Join us Friday afternoon at 2:30 for The Gathering, a Modern Thanksgiving Story.
Mostly sunny in Champaign-Urbana today with a high around 45 degrees. Mostly clear skies tonight, the low 32. Sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 58. Partly cloudy tomorrow night, the low down to 40. Partly sunny Sunday with a chance of rain, the high around 48 degrees. Mostly cloudy Sunday night, a chance of rain, the low 35. Mostly cloudy Monday with a high of 42 degrees. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3, Urbana. From the